The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here with Harold Teal, the owner of Hidden Bench Winery. Just an absolutely gorgeous, impressive place that I'm shocked it took me this long to actually do the interview. Harold, appreciate you taking the time. Good morning. Thanks for being on.
Well, looking forward to have a chat with you.
Yeah, and there's so much to get into. Let's just start here. How did you go from the audio-visual world of business to making killer Niagara wine?
I think you have to be passionate to be involved in the wine industry in Niagara, and I've always had a passion for wine. And interesting, there was a wine that I tasted that sort of opened my eyes, and for us older folks, it was a wine made by Deborah Paskus. It was the Temkin Paskus Chardonnay that she made from the Rosamel Vineyard in 1998.
Really?
And I opened that wine and I said, wow. And so I tracked down where the wine came from. And then, I was looking to be, I was mid-career and...
And what was that career, by the way?
I was in the audiovisual business. We used to rent audiovisual and video equipment for meetings and conventions and trade shows, and we had offices right across North America. I was skiing with a buddy, and he had sudden cardiac arrest on a ski hill in Austria in 2003, and I jumped on his chest, and I did CPR and mouth-to-mouth on him, and I thought about, you think about your own life when you're doing this, and in doing so, I said to myself, if Jean makes it through this, I am going to exit the audiovisual business and I'm going to start a small winery. And every time I see him, I blame him for either the money we've invested, or for the success we've had. And he's still with us today as well.
That is a hell of a story. That is certainly much more traumatic than I was on a bike in Burgundy as a 20-year-old with a baguette and a Moussigny, and then I fell in love with wine. Okay, so something interesting here. You must have a high level of curiosity, and you also must have a high level of love for wine before 2004, where a bottle of Chardonnay helped push you into wanting to make Niagara wine. Where did your love of wine start from? Because clearly not in 04.
No, I think it started way before that. Our, European family, my mother is Austrian, my father was German. Wine was part of our lifestyle. We always had wine at the table and wine from all over the world, not just from German wine or Austrian wine. And certainly, I went to school overseas. I went to school in France, and that's where my love of Burgundy just got more emphasized. On weekends, we used to travel to Burgundy and taste. Essentially, I said, wow, it would be great to own a winery one day. You think of these dreams that you have when you're 20 years old, mm-hmm. but I had to follow a business, and my brother and I were in business together, and it was a family business, and we were able to grow the business and be very successful, and I think this incident was sort of what was Jean in 2003 is sort of what propelled me to say, you know what, I got to do it now or never.
Right.
Yeah, and that's basically what propelled me to start Hidden Bench. And at the time, to be honest, I just didn't look at Ontario. I was looking at Oregon. I was looking at France. But I still had children who were in school. So, pulling your kids out of school to start a winery in some other geographic area was really not very well accepted by my spouse, Anne. So we decided that we were going to see what we could do here. And I think the catalyst was this bottle, the single bottle of Temkin Paskus Chardonnay, which I probably purchased in 2003, 2002. And, I still have wines, that I bought around that time. There was a Red Meritage, for example, that was made by Vineland Estates from 1998, which was incredible as well. And so I said, we can make really good wine here, and that's the catalyst.
And that was at a time when, you know, we're nowhere near as consistent with our quality in 2025, what it was in 1998. And yet there were still tons of great wine out there. I'd love to hear a little bit about the process of finding here, finding what was it about this area and these vineyards where you realized I can make great Burgundian wines, eventually great Riesling with a German background as well.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear about that process.
I think, you know, like everything, I'm a pretty process-driven individual. So I asked around and I found out where the grapes for that great wine that I had tasted came from. And both of those wines, the Red Meritage from Vineland Estates, as well as the Temkin Pascus Chardonnay, both came from a single vineyard on the bench, the Rosamel Vineyard, which we now own. Okay, and I tracked down the owner. His name was Roman Perdukovich, and everybody referred me to him because Roman was not only a vintner, but he was a part-time real estate agent as well. And Roman, I asked him, I said, listen, I don't know anything about growing grapes. Could I come and work with you and learn how to grow grapes? And he was very, very accepting of me to come and help him in 2003, 2004. And then that was eventually... You know, he said, listen, you know, the best wines in the region come from the bench. And he was the first person. And when you talk of, when you were talking to other people at the time, you know, guys like Norm Beale or Maury Taz or Brian Schmidt, you know, there was a propensity to be on the bench side. We did look at some property in Niagara on a Lake, but I found the wines that really moved me were wines that came, that had been come from vineyards on the bench, and that's how we ended up on the bench. And our focus was always to make, be an estate winery and to make wines with grapes grown on the Beamsville bench.
What is it about Beamsville bench, which is a sub-appellation, I believe? So Beamsville bench, and people hear, oh yeah, benchland wines or benchland fruit, and yeah. That term's getting used more and more. What is it specifically about here, the terroir, the climate, the soil, whatever, that makes the quality of wines that you love?
Well, I think if you have to go look at this from a geological and a geographical
Let's location. Do it.
You go back 450 million years ago, this whole area was covered by a lake, Lake Iroquois. And then after that, there was geophysical activity which caused the escarpment, and then there were four glacial periods. And each time the glaciers receded, they pulled back the old base of Lake Iroquois, which was full of limestone, clay, and silt, and deposited it at the base of the Niagara Escarpment. And that's the benches. You know, you can call them Beamsville Bench, 20 Mile Bench, St. David's Bench, the Short Hills Bench. They're basically all glacial deposits that are not homogeneous. They basically have a blending of different soil types within a single parcel of land. When we replanted the Felsic Vineyard, we did soil pits, and there's eight different types of soil within that 35 acre block, and that is what gives the wines their complexity, the variability of the soil, and the fact that you have limestone. Like Felsic has 7 to 8% of active limestone, which you don't find on the flatlands down below, or you find in Niagara Lake. It's very different. You know, the soils are less fertile, so you have lower yields naturally, but you have this great complexity in the wines.
What were the first couple of years? And by the way, it's a great answer. And I'm always trying to push whenever I talk to winemakers or wine owners from this area to really drill down. Let me know, what is it about this appellation versus this appellation? Everyone knows, or people that are into wine, they know Côte de Beaune versus Côte de Nuits. They know why Saint-Emilion is different than Médoc.
Or Pomerol,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I think it's important to keep telling that story. And it might seem sciencey, and it might turn some people off, but the science and the geological part of the conversation, I think, is an important one. What were the first couple of years like for you? You found the property, you love the limestone, you love the Chardonnay, you're moving on to the next chapter of your life. What were those first couple of years like for you, Harold?
Well, 2004 was a disaster. Okay, so... 04, we...
The vintage, the 04 vintage. Oh, yeah.
So 04, I know when I'm first year out, we had no facility. I was making wine in a basement that had no temperature control. And suffice to say that the wine that we made didn't meet our standards and didn't meet my standards. And I decided to sell it off in bulk. and not bottle the wine. But at the end of the day, I think that was a very wise decision because we want to come out of the gate making great wine. And I believe that we had to build a really great team. And the team, you know, first person you hire is a winemaker. And we hired a winemaker named Jean-Martin Bouchard, who had been out west, was from Quebec, but had been working out west. And he joined us. And you know, our really first vintage where we had the facility built and that we were able to make wine the way we'd like to make wine was in 2005. You know, we made some great wines that year, but small quantities. I mean, we did bottling runs that were like 400 bottles, and everyone starts there. I mean, when you have these, you know, we currently have a lot of garagistes making wine in the area, and they start off with small quantities, and that's how you grow the business. And our goal from day one was always to make wines that Canadians could serve with pride, not sort of here's my Canadian wine and it's, and we want to stand shoulder to shoulder with the best in the world. And you know, let's be honest, Pinot Chardonnay, it's Burgundy, Sonoma Coast, maybe a little bit in northern Italy, but the key and Champagne. But the key component here was attention to detail all the way from the vineyard to the bottle, and that's what our focus was.
What was the reaction of your wife, friends, and your accountant in 2004 when you're like, nope, we can't sell any of this wine. We can't make any of our own wine. We got to sell it off bulk to others.
Well, thank God we could sell it off in bulk.
You can still make money.
And in fact, some of the wine did actually quite well in national competitions, even though
Hold on, did that upset you? Be like, no, don't make good wine this year.
No. I think at the end of the day, the wine that we made, some of the wine was good, some of the wine was terrible, and you want to come out of the blocks, particularly with the business plan we had to be an ultra premium winery from day one and to make wines that sort of benchmark wines, you know, can. You know, you can use whatever term you want to describe. We want to be at the, you know, having done the analysis, I realized that being a boutique winery in Ontario and trying to handpick fruit and really with a great attention to detail, that you couldn't sell wine at $15 a bottle. I wasn't, you know, unless you're a high volume, that doesn't work. And I had been to Oregon, I had traveled through Oregon, I saw what Pinot and was selling for in Oregon, and I realized that we need to be at that price point to be a viable, sustainable business.
How much, and it still is difficult, it's one of my favorite pet topics on this pod, it's price. How much easier is it now in 2025 than say 2010 to sell wine, to sell Niagara wine that is over $30, $35. I've tasted your wines. $50 is fair. It's very fair just because of the process of you making the wine. But for you, how much more acceptance is there today versus 15 years ago at those price points?
It's a good question. Really good question. I don't think it's changed that much.
Oh, damn
it. For us. I think that you'll always have premium producers, smaller volume producers that will be premium. You know, I look at our little neighborhood here, you have Le Clos Jardin, you have ourselves, you have Thomas, you have Moritas, you know, you have Cloudsley, you have Westcott. There is a cadre of premium producers who make really good wine west of Niagara, okay? And you have the same down in Niagara Lake as well. You know, you look at Stratus, you look at some of those.
Yeah, Southbrook, Kirby with their Merlots.
Kirby, yeah. On 7. You know, there's a lot.
Ooh, on 7. Yeah, excellent Chardonnay.
Yeah, and Dobbin now.
Yeah.
So we've carved out a niche of premium producers who make great wine. The biggest problem we have is that the people who, our potential client base is very much entrenched with California, Oregon, Burgundy, and Italy.
Yeah.
That's where they're entrenched. Our job is to, you know, it's a hand sell. You convince them that you have great wines. And when people taste the wines, they go, you know what, this is really good value. Particularly if I look at our two entry-level Chardonnay and Pinot, the ones that are in vintages, the estate wines, those wines, you know, the Chardonnay is $32, the Pinot Noir is $38, or thereabouts, and they really over deliver on a PQR. And I think that's the important thing, is to over deliver on the price quality ratio, not in relationship to other wines from Ontario, but primarily in relationship to benchmark wines from other great wine growing regions. Chablis, Côte d'Or, Côte d'Aubon.
We'll get back into you, but just because I've been sipping on the first wine here, what is it that that we're drinking, the first Chardonnay here?
The first wine that we're tasting here is the our Chardonnay Beton. It's a new wine for Hidden Bench, about, I think it's our third vintage. This is concrete egg fermented Chardonnay with extended lees contact. You know, we all, you know, the model for this wine was we were really looking to craft a un-oaked Chardonnay that could stand shoulder to shoulder with some of the best in the world. And we all know where those came from. They come from Chablis,
yeah,
or they come from Oregon or Sonoma Coast now.
And on the nose, it doesn't scream stainless steel. And like, oh, nope, there's the concrete.
Yeah.
And it spends a bunch of time on lees. And like, okay, that's where the body is coming from. And we had a little mini tour. How important is concrete and the future of using concrete for prices, for the style of wine you want to make? Because you guys have a pretty extensive concrete program here, certainly more than I've seen in Ontario.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, you never stop innovating when you're a small winery. You know, we sort of knocked off great Pinot Noir. We do five great Pinot Noirs. We do four great Chardonnays before the Beton. We were really getting some inquiries from our we have an extensive wine club saying, you know, it'd be really great to get a good un-oaked Chardonnay as well that has some weight and body to it and is not just lean and
insipid lemon lime.
Yeah, you understand.
Yeah. Right?
And so we you know, research is fun, you know, so we took the team, we headed off to Chablis, we tasted with the eight organic producers in Chablis, and some of them are out there, but some of them are very traditional. There's, you know, Christian Moreau is organic. We tasted with Thomas Pico, who is, you know, who is sort of known as the wild man of Chablis, a young producer, and the ones that we, and Claude Beru as well. And what we realized is that the wines that we really were drawn to were these wines that had been fermented in concrete as opposed to being done in stainless steel and then maybe with a portion being done in barrel and a combination of the two. But we really liked the terroir that showed through in the concrete fermented wines. So that's the direction we went, and we did some research and we were able to find some really great concrete tanks. And one of the criteria was is we wanted to be able to heat and cool these tanks to not only for fermentation control, because we use indigenous yeast, but also in terms of aging the wines. We want to keep them at a good temperature for aging on lees as well.
How much more expensive is oak now than, say, before COVID?
I think it peaked during COVID. And then the big thing with oak particularly is the cost of transport. You know, you're bringing containers from across the sea, and you know, it's one of those areas where there's actually no control over the three companies who monopolize the container shipments in the world. Pre-COVID, we could bring a 40-foot container for like $3,200 to $3,700. Okay. Sorry about the phone. Let me turn that off.
Yeah, we'll pause for a quick second.
Okay. We'll pause for a second.
Yeah, pause for a quick second. And we are back. The phones are off. A different shard has been poured. We'll talk about it in a second, but we'll just pick up right where we left off.
Yeah.
And that was about the cost of oak now versus what it was 5-10 years ago.
I think oak is getting much more expensive. Quality oak. You know, you can buy American oak, you can buy French oak. We at Hidden Bench tend to use, well, we only use French oak because it's a different species, a different type of tree. Tends to impact the wine less, as a little bit more subtle on the wine. And with transport and everything, I think we're probably looking at somewhere, I'd say probably a 40% increase, 40 to 50% increase in oak costs since we started. A lot of wines no longer use oak barrels. They can use oak chips, they use planks, you know. So a lot of times if you taste oak in a wine, it might not necessarily be an oak barrel. We also ferment our wines in oak barrels as opposed to fermenting them in stainless steel and then aging them in oak.
Right.
Which is a different process as well.
Yeah. And yeah, like the oak chips, it's not the same. And by the way, for people out there afraid of oak, never be afraid of oak. Be afraid of bad winemaking, because oak in the hands of the smart people it's always going to be good. It's going to have body structure, all that sort of stuff. Like, we'll talk about the second Chardonnay, but both these Chardonnays we've had. Yeah. First one completely unoaked, used in concrete. And this one here that I took just one quick sip of. There is no over-aggressiveness here. There's nothing about these wines that someone would get nervous about Chardonnay and any sort of oaky characteristic overwhelming.
Well, I think Matt, you've touched on something, which is one of the benefits of being in a cool climate region. You know, Chardonnay is a cool climate grape, and we have to acknowledge that. I'm not sure that Chardonnay should be grown in Sicily or should be grown in maybe even in California going forward. Very different style. They're very big. The best Chardonnays that I like from California are Sonoma Coast, which is a cooler appellation. But I think what happens, particularly with oak, is the warmer the climate, the higher the alcohol in the Chardonnay, the larger extraction you get of oak tannins. And that can be something that's a little bit over the top with certain wines. And then with this Felsic Chardonnay, what you're seeing is it's great. You know, there's a subtlety to it. It does have oak, but if I look at great Burgundies, and I'll throw out some names like Pierre-Yves Collin or his wife, I mean, those wines, when they are released, have a pretty strong presence of oak.
Yeah.
But it's not, it complements the wine. It doesn't overpower the wine. And yeah, that's what we're looking to do.
Yeah. Don't be afraid of Chardonnay. Don't be afraid of oak. Or you know what? No. Go be afraid of Chardonnay. More for me. I'm fine with that. You mentioned the vineyard. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit just about the different vineyards and what each one of them brings in terms of characteristics.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. We have three distinct vineyards. There will be a fourth in the future, which we're just starting to plant. But the first vineyard, let's start with the first, which is where right here at the winery, is the Locust Lane vineyard. Was planted in 98, was the first planting here of grapes. These vineyards now are 25 years old, some of the new replants are a little bit younger. But the idea being that the soils here in the Locust Lane vineyard tend to be deeper clay, less limestone, so really well suited, and you know, to the wines that come from here, the wines that most people would know here would be our Pinot Noir, our Locust Lane Pinot Noir, which tends to have really dark fruit characters and that forest floor character, which is really interesting. So here we have less limestone, more clay. Across the street is the Felsic Vineyard, and the Felsic Vineyard is the one that we've really reworked a lot and replanted. We still have some legacy blocks of Chardonnay that were planted 88 and 92, and that's what we're tasting here. These vines now are you know, what's great about as time goes by is, and as you get older, the vines also get older and tend to produce, you know, some pretty significant wines. The Felsic Vineyard has a unique mineral character to the wines on the Riesling side, on the Pinot side, as well as on the Pinot Noir side as well. And the Chardonnay side is also very good. Then Rosamel is a unique, and the vines are much older. Some of them, we don't even know what the clone is.
Really?
The rootstock. They were planted. The vineyards were planted before. If I look at, we have a block there that is of Chardonnay that's 50 years old, which is the Tête de Cuvée Chardonnay parcel. We have Riesling at the same age. We have some Merlot that is 45 years old, and you know, which is pretty exciting as well. So that vineyard tends to have soils that are lighter, more silty, and less clay. So the wines tend to be more of a lighter style. You know, in days gone by, the term would have been used, they're more feminine. That's something that no one uses anymore. We just find them a lighter style, more fruit forward, and less on that. The Felsic always delivers like the mountain of Corton. It delivers It delivers that sort of savory character of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. It's more in graphite notes that you see in those mineral wines.
Yeah. So more Barbaresco, less Barolo, if we're not going to use feminine, masculine, or things like that.
Exactly, yeah.
Speaking of Merlot, what does a 1970 Chateau Cheval Blanc taste like?
It's pretty tasty.
On the website, it says that was your aha wine.
Yeah.
Do you remember the moment?
I remember the moment. The first time when I was going to school in France in early 80s, we used to go to a restaurant about 5 kilometers away from the school where I was attending in Seattle. group of four of us would go every second or third Friday, and we were sort of the lady who owned the restaurant was a very small country style restaurant, and the lady who owned her, she had lost her husband the previous winter, and she sort of took us under her wing, and lo and behold, her husband had a fantastic cellar. And one of the things that he had a slew of 1970 Chateau Cheval Blanc, which, just to make people cry, at that time we were buying
how much
in the restaurant for 75 francs a bottle, so about $12 is what we were paying in the restaurant.
$12 Canadian dollars in a restaurant for 1970 Cheval Blanc
in 1982.
God.
But those are that's what it was. And this gentleman had been a big buyer of 1970. He had it in magnums and double magnums and 750s. And every time we went, she knew exactly what we wanted to have. We would have a côte de bœuf à la moelle, with, the accompaniments, and also a bottle of Cheval Blanc. So that's why it brings back such great memories.
Of course.
My cellar, I have a number of Cheval Blancs in my cellar from many, many years. And I think it's one of those, for me, it's a benchmark wine. It's a wine that you can, that anybody who drinks it, even if you're a New World fan or an Old World fan, it has enough of that sort of New World characteristic in terms of being very fruit forward, as well as having that textural feel that you find in New World wines, but it's classic Bordeaux as well.
Well, Harold, because you're generous with your time, and I'm a generous person, I'll buy a bottle of that 1970 and I'll pay double. I'll pay $24 for it. Don't talk me out of it. $24, double what you paid. And
unfortunately, I stopped buying. I used to buy Cheval Blanc every year when they came out in release.
Of course.
The pre-release.
And at some point.
1999, I still bought it. 2000, when the price per bottle went over $1,000 a bottle, I said, I'm not paying that for wine.
Yeah.
But it still does, it's a very... It's a very, very impressive wine, and the attention to detail in the whole process of crafting that wine is incredible.
It is. Oh, God, yeah. Speaking of Bordeaux, we've talked all about your Chardonnays, and we should, because, it's one of the things you guys are known for.
Yeah.
We'll talk Pinot in a moment, but actually we'll do this in a weird order. To tell people a little bit about your Bordeaux blend portfolios here. Yeah.
So we have we actually craft every year a blended Bordeaux style blend, or Meritage blend, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
The Bordelais are very smart people. They've been crafting wine for a long time, and they realize that not every vintage is the same. It's every vintage with Bordeaux varietals can be different, and you can have different grapes will perform better in different years. And by blending, crafting blended wines, you can really improve the quality. So we have legacy blocks of of Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, and Cabernet Sauvignon. Okay, we have the largest planting of Malbec, I think, in the province, and we have a total of 4 acres of producing Malbec. It's not a lot,
but that's a lot compared to anyone else.
Yeah, and it really does add a lot. So we do a Merlot dominant blend. It's always Merlot dominant. Merlot, Malbec, Cabernet Franc, and a little bit of Cabernet Sauvignon. And we had some vines that were virused. Our Cabernet Sauvignon was virused, and we pulled it out because we didn't want it to infect the other vines. And we've replanted that now, and our first production from the new planting is in 2021. So we're excited about that. So the blend is very much a right bank style blend. And then in exceptional years, we make the terroir cachet every year, in exceptional years, we make a second blend. We take the best barrels of the terroir cachet, and we make a wine called Labrinant, which is often referred to as one of the benchmark Bordeaux-style blends in the region. In fact, we currently have the 2020 of both on the shelf, which was an exceptional vintage for Bordeaux style wines. And then occasionally we have leftover Malbec, we will also do a single varietal bottling of Malbec as well. But we don't do a single varietal of Cabernet Franc or a single varietal of Merlot yet. our new plantings in our new vineyard, we planted three different clones of Cabernet Franc. And in 2030, we will probably have a single varietal Cabernet Franc available.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how suspicious do you get when you see an Ontario bottle that is 100% Cabernet Sauvignon?
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, there's a lot of industrial processes that have been applied to Cabernet Sauvignon over the years. You know, you have flash détente is being done, you know, which is a technique. You have people who are doing Amarone style wines as well. I think Cabernet Franc could be the future for Ontario in 15, 20 years as things get warmer. Okay.
Pearl right. Merset, Stratus, Cassaba. Yeah. There's a lot of great Cab Franc out there. Yeah. But
Cabernet Franc. Did I say Cabernet Franc?
You said Franc.
I meant Sauvignon.
Well, hold on. You think Cabernet Sauvignon...
In 20 years.
How much of a climate catastrophe do we have if Cabernet Sauvignon could be the number one grape in this area? I'm still getting
I'm not saying number one grape. I think one of the problems that we have, and this is something that we need to talk about as an industry, is some of the plantings of Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc that we are currently in the ground in Ontario are virused vines, and so they're it's very difficult to push to complete ripeness a vine that has virus. If it has red blotch or leaf roll, those will tend to be cause problems. But I'd say 1 year out of three currently, you can probably ripen Cabernet Sauvignon really well and make a great wine. Mm-hmm. You need to get that to be more consistent. Every year ripen. Like we can ripen the key varietals that Ontario can ripen every year. Chardonnay, Riesling, Gamay, Cabernet Franc, Pinot Noir, for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, and that's where we should be focusing.
I agree. For me, the reason I ask the question is because Cabernet Sauvignon can be an easier wine to sell. Everyone knows it. It's safe. It's comfort food. But here, underripe green bell pepper. I remember Lely was the first time I ever tried a 100% Cabernet Sauvignon that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I was always suspicious. I was even suspicious of Lely. Then I took a sip. I'm like, I guess I got to change my expectations a little bit.
Yeah.
So that I'm always curious.
Well, we had at Rosamond, we had Cabernet Sauvignon planted and I pulled it out.
Right.
Yeah. And I planted Pinot in its place because I didn't think it was the right thing to go. Yeah.
How would you describe, and your Pinots are going to be different depending on the vineyard and all that jazz. How would you describe what a hidden bench Pinot Noir is? it's a tough question because it's wide, it's overarching. It can mean so many different things depending on the vintage. If I think of you guys, I think of Pinot and I think of Chardonnay. Last time I was here, I bought a bottle of your Riesling.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of that as well.
Yeah.
But when I think of you guys first, I think of Pinot and Chard.
Yeah, so I think our Pinot Noirs are definitely not California Pinot Noirs.
They are not.
Okay. They probably have a greater similarity to Burgundy Pinot Noirs than they do to California Pinot Noirs or even Oregon Pinot Noirs. A lot of the fruit bombs that we get in terms of Pinot Noirs that come from the New World, particularly from California, I'm not trying to diss California Pinot Noirs, but a lot of the Pinot Noirs that people find extremely popular are not 100% Pinot Noir. This is a dirty little secret that nobody wants to talk about. They can put Pinot Noir on the label and have 24.999% of another grape varietal in there.
Syrah, and suddenly it's a 15.5% Russian River Valley.
Petit Syrah.
Oh, Petit Syrah in Pinot?
Syrah is one of the key blenders because it's cheaper than Syrah.
Oh.
So they'll use Petit Syrah in it. So when you tend, I'm not going to mention any California brands, but I taste wines that... There are some that are 100% Pinot Noir, the purists, but there are some that are the top selling Pinot Noirs in vintages or in the board that have that large component of another grape varietal and also carry a lot of residual sugar. So our Pinot Noirs are dry, they're unfined, unfiltered, they are pure expressions of the terroir of their origin. I think that's a key component. We use indigenous yeast. The attention to detail is like Burgundy. Hand-picked fruit. We sort the bunches. We then sort the individual berries. And sometimes we do whole clusters. Sometimes we don't, depending on the year and the block. But the flavor profile is not savory. It's more what I would call mineral, like it has a minerality to it that is very prevalent in the wine. They age extremely well as well. But you know, we're currently, certain restaurants are serving like the 09 and 10 of our Pinot Noir, because they really do come into their own after about 4 or 5 years because they're unfined and unfiltered.
Yeah, and it's a tip of the cap. When it's always good to surprise someone when they try an Ontario Pinot that's 10, 15 years old and still so fresh and still has another decade left.
Yeah.
We will end with a happy question, but before we end with that, second last question for you. I read the piece you did with Rick Van Sickle and Wines in Niagara, and anyone listening to this pod knows you got to read other. If you like Niagara wines, like Ontario wines, Rick Van Sickle is the first place that you should go to. Does the Ontario government give the wine industry, which helps tax dollars, tourism, it's also farmers?
Yeah.
Is the Ontario government doing enough to help support your industry?
If you would have asked me this question a year ago, mm-hmm. my answer would be completely different. I really do think that the current government, or we're in election process now, the PC government of the last year has really supported our industry.
Good.
Particularly smaller producers. The elephant in the room still is access to shelf space in the LCBO. I mean, that's one of the things that we need to enhance, and that's the government has given the LCBO some very good directives in that regard. The Ministry of Finance has done that, and I think we're getting good financial support. But a lot of the financial support is based on sales in the LCBO, and so if you're a small winery, you can't get into the LCBO, you're not benefiting from a lot of the programs. And I think that's something that we need to work on over the next year or so. And I think there's things are in progress. I'm
good.
I'm excited about the future of the industry. It's a very different industry now than it was when we started. You know, when we started, you had to own land. If you didn't own land, you couldn't get a license. You had to grow grapes. If you didn't grow grapes, you couldn't get a license. It was really a farm-based. Now there's a lot of new entrants into the marketplace who buy fruit and make wine at another winery and have their own brand and are investing in their brand, but are not land-based wineries. And I think the land-based wineries is really where we can differentiate ourselves.
All right, that's great to hear, because I've talked to winemakers for years and years, and it was always taxes too high, not enough support. And that's good to see with the Ford government. And, you know, I've talked to Neil Lumsden, you know, about it before. And I think that's important, because you guys are so important to tourism in Southern Ontario, and tax dollars, and young people that work at wineries all across Ontario. And the fact is that making wine, you're farmers. Who doesn't want to support farmers?
I think that's a really good comment. And I think one of the things is that only once people see the passion and the emotion that goes into making and crafting a great wine, do they realize how important this is to our industry. The economic benefit of crafted wines is huge, much greater than wines that are, you know, just bottled here. We have to realize that we're supporting farmers and farm families, and that's an important aspect of what we do. And we have to have confidence. You know, I think, unfortunately, you know, typical Canadian thing is you have to be successful elsewhere before Canadians will be embrace you. And you know, when our Felsic Chardonnay, the one that we just tasted, that wine was one of the top wines in the world in 2021, the 2018 vintage at Decanter. And all of a sudden, everybody wants the wine.
If Decanter says it's good, it almost like it gives permission to people that only drink French wine. Oh, Decanter likes it, thus I can now like it.
Exactly.
That's so frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
It's like Tragically Hip became more famous when they went on Saturday Night Live and Dan Aykroyd
introduced them. French life, you go, Céline Dion was really not popular until she was popular in France.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting aspect.
Less La Crema, more Hidden Bench Chardonnay at the LCBO. That would just be a very simple way to make life better. Your joy for wine, is it the same? Is it different? Is it deeper? Your relationship now with wine, Harold, today versus back in 04?
I have to admit that I still buy wine from away, because I think and I love sharing those wines with our team here at Hidden Bench. Because for a lot of people, you know, as you know, Matt, with the cost of Burgundy today, most people can't afford to buy it.
No.
And you know, we always do tastings, you know, we do sort of a I'll send people to the cellar at the house here and say, you know, go choose some wines that we're going to do a tasting with the vintage crew tonight, or with the retail crew. And by tasting wines from away, you can then really appreciate what we are doing here in Niagara. I still love wine. I still love the attachment to the soil. I love the attachment to the sense of place. And for me, that's an important, the future bodes well. And I think I look forward to continuing to craft excellent wines here at Hidden Bench.
Harold, really appreciate it. This has been great. I am late to Hidden Bench. It's only really been like the last couple of years, which absolutely shocks me. But it also speaks to the quality in the bench that it could take me this long to find you, because there's other great producers.
Excellent.
Your Chards, your Pinots. Love the Riesling. I have one bottle of your highest end Bordeaux blend hidden away somewhere else. And it's a testament. I love your story. I love just the change you made in 03 and 04 and that you followed your passion. And I appreciate you taking time to join me today.
Well, thank you very much for finally coming to visit.
Yeah.
Our name is hidden for a reason. Okay? It's Hidden Bench. And I hope that that some of your podcast listeners who haven't been here make the trek to visit us.
What's the website?
Hiddenbench.com.
Hiddenbench.com. It can't get easier than that. Thanks so much, Harold.
Have a great day.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.